If Mother were to walk alongside the Shirakawa stream on a lovely spring day, when you could almost see beauty itself dripping into the water from the tendrils of the cherry trees, she probably wouldn't even notice any of it unless, I don't know, she had a plan to make money from selling the trees or some such thing. Before my mizuage, I don't think it made any difference to Mother that Hatsumomo was causing trouble for me in Gion, but now that I had a high price tag on me, she put a stop to Hatsumomo's troublemaking without my even having to ask it of her. I don't know how she did it. Probably she just said, "Hatsumomo, if your behavior causes problems for Sayuri and costs this Okiya money, you'll be the one to pay it." Ever since my mother had grown ill, my life had certainly been difficult, but now for a time, things became remarkably uncomplicated. I won't say I never felt tired or disappointed. In fact, I felt tired much of the time. Life in Gion is hardly relaxing for the women who make a living there, but it was certainly a great relief to be freed from the threat of Hatsumomo. Inside the Okiya too, life was almost pleasurable. As the adopted daughter, I ate when I wanted. I chose my kimono first instead of waiting for Pumpkin to choose hers, and the moment I'd made my choice, Auntie set to work sewing the seams to the proper width and basting the collar onto my underrobe before she'd touched even Hatsumomo's. I didn't mind when Hatsumomo looked at me with resentment and hatred because of the special treatment I now received, but when Pumpkin passed me in the Okiya with a worried look and kept her eyes averted from mine, even when we were face to face, it caused me terrible pain. I'd always had the feeling our friendship would have grown if only circumstances hadn't come between us. I didn't have that feeling any longer. With my mizuage behind me, Dr. Crabb disappeared from my life almost completely. I say almost because even though Mameha and I no longer went to the Shirei tea house to entertain him, I did run into him occasionally at parties in Gion. The Baron, on the other hand, I never saw again. I didn't yet know about the role he'd played in driving up the price of my mizuage, but as I look back, I can understand why Mameha may have wanted to keep us apart. Probably I would have felt every bit as uncomfortable around the Baron as Mameha would have felt having me there. In any case, I can't pretend I missed either of these men. But there was one man I was very eager to see again, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you I'm talking about the chairman. He hadn't played any role in Mameha's plan, so I didn't expect my relationship with him to change or come to an end just because my mizuage was over. Still, I have to admit, I felt very relieved a few weeks afterward to learn that Iwamura Electric had called to request my company once again. When I arrived that evening, both the chairman and Nobu were present. In the past, I would certainly have gone to sit beside Nobu, but now that Mother had adopted me, I wasn't obliged to think of him as my savior any longer. As it happened, a space beside the chairman was vacant, and so, with a feeling of excitement, I went to take it. The chairman was very cordial when I poured him sake, and thanked me by raising his cup in the air before drinking it. But all evening long, he never looked at me, whereas Nobu, whenever I glanced in his direction, glared back at me as though I were the only person in the room he was aware of. I certainly knew what it was like to long for someone, so before the evening was over, I made a point of going to spend a bit of time with him. I was careful never to ignore him again after this. A month or so passed, and then, one evening during a party, I happened to mention to Nobu that Mameha had arranged for me to appear in a festival in Hiroshima. I wasn't sure he was listening when I told him, but the very next day when I returned to the Okiya after my lessons, I found in my room a new wooden travel trunk he'd sent me as a gift. The trunk was much finer even than the one I'd borrowed from Auntie for the Baron's party in Hakone. I felt terribly ashamed of myself for having thought I could simply discard Nobu now that he was no longer central to any plans Mameha might have had. I wrote him a note of thanks, and told him I looked forward to expressing my gratitude in person when I saw him the following week at a large party Iwamura Electric had planned some months in advance. But then a peculiar thing happened. Shortly before the party, I received a message that my company wouldn't be needed after all. Yoko, who worked at the telephone in our Okiya, was under the impression the party had been canceled. As it happened, I had to go to the Ichiriki that night anyway for another party. Just as I was kneeling in the hallway to enter, I saw the door to a large banquet room down at the end slide open, and a young geisha named Katsue came out. Before she closed the door, I heard what I felt certain was the sound of the chairman's laughter coming from inside the room. I was very puzzled by this, so I rose from my knees and went to catch Katsue before she left the tea house. "I'm very sorry to trouble you," I said, "but have you just come from the party given by Iwamura Electric?" "Yes, it's quite lively. There must be 25 geisha and nearly 50 men." "And Chairman Iwamura and Nobu-san are both there?" I asked her. "Not Nobu. Apparently he went home sick this morning. He'll be very sorry to have missed it. But the chairman is there. Why do you ask?" I muttered something. I don't remember what it was, and she left. Up until this moment, I'd somehow imagined that the chairman valued my company as much as Nobu did. Now I had to wonder whether it had all been an illusion, and Nobu was the only one who cared. Chapter 25. Mameha may already have won her bet with Mother, but she still had quite a stake in my future. So during the next few years, she worked to make my face familiar to all her best customers, and to the other geisha in Gion as well. We were still emerging from the Depression at this time. Formal banquets weren't as common as Mameha would have liked. But she took me to plenty of informal gatherings, not only parties in the tea houses, but swimming excursions, sightseeing tours, kabuki plays, and so on. During the heat of summer, when everyone felt most relaxed, these casual gatherings were often quite a lot of fun, even for those of us supposedly hard at work entertaining. For example, a group of men sometimes decided to go floating in a canal boat along the Kamo River, to sip sake and dangle their feet in the water. I was too young to join in the carousing, and often ended up with the job of shaving ice to make snow cones, but it was a pleasant change nevertheless. Some nights, wealthy businessmen or aristocrats threw geisha parties just for themselves. They spent the evening dancing and singing and drinking with the geisha, often until well after midnight. I remember on one of these occasions, the wife of our host stood at the door to hand out envelopes containing a generous tip as we left. She gave Mameha two of them and asked her the favor of delivering the second to the geisha, Tomizuro, who had gone home earlier with a headache, as she put it. Actually, she knew as well as we did that Tomizuro was her husband's mistress and had gone with him to another wing of the house to keep him company for the night. Many of the glamorous parties in Gion were attended by famous artists and writers and kabuki actors, and sometimes they were very exciting events. But I'm sorry to tell you that the average geisha party was something much more mundane. The host was likely to be the division head of a small company, and the guest of honor one of his suppliers, or perhaps one of his employees he just promoted, or something along those lines. Every so often, some well-meaning geisha admonished me that as an apprentice, my responsibility, besides trying to look pretty, was to sit quietly and listen to conversations in the hopes of one day becoming a clever conversationalist myself. Well, most of the conversations I heard at these parties didn't strike me as very clever at all. A man might turn to the geisha beside him and say, "The weather certainly is unusually warm, don't you think?" And the geisha would reply with something like, "Oh yes, very warm." Then she'd begin playing a drinking game with him, or try to get all the men singing, and soon the man who'd spoken with her was too drunk to remember he wasn't having as good a time as he'd hoped. For my part, I always considered this a terrible waste. If a man has come to Gion just for the purpose of having a relaxing time, and ends up involved in some childish game such as paper, scissors, stone, well, in my view, he'd have been better off staying at home and playing with his own children or grandchildren, who, after all, are probably more clever than this poor, dull geisha he was so unfortunate as to sit beside. Every so often, though, I was privileged to overhear a geisha who really was clever, and Mameha was certainly one of these. I learned a great deal from her conversations. For example, if a man said to her, "Warm weather, don't you think?" she had a dozen replies ready. If he was old and lecherous, she might say to him, "Warm, perhaps it's just the effect on you of being around so many lovely women." Or if he was an arrogant young businessman who didn't seem to know his place, she might take him off his guard by saying, "Here you are sitting with a half dozen of the best geisha in Gion, and all you can think to talk about is the weather." One time when I happened to be watching her, Mameha knelt beside a very young man who couldn't have been more than 19 or 20. He probably wouldn't have been at a geisha party at all if his father hadn't been the host. Of course, he didn't know what to say or how to behave around Geisha, and I'm sure he felt nervous. But he turned to Mameha very bravely and said to her, "Warm, isn't it?" She lowered her voice and answered him like this, "Why, you're certainly right about it being warm. You should have seen me when I stepped out of the bath this morning. Usually, when I'm completely naked, I feel so cool and relaxed. But this morning, there were little beads of sweat covering my skin, all the way up my body, along my thighs and on my stomach and, well, other places, too." When that poor boy set his sake cup down on the table, his fingers were trembling. I'm sure he never forgot that geisha party for the rest of his life. If you ask me why most of these parties were so dull, I think probably there are two reasons. First, just because a young girl has been sold by her family and raised from an early age to be a geisha doesn't mean she'll turn out to be clever or have anything interesting to say. And second, the same thing goes for the men. Just because a man has made enough money to come to Gion and waste it however he chooses doesn't mean he's fun to be around. In fact, many of the men are accustomed to being treated with a great deal of respect. Sitting back with their hands on their knees and big frowns on their faces is about as much work as they plan to do in the way of being entertaining. One time I listened to Mameha spend an entire hour telling stories to a man who never even looked in her direction, but just watched the others in the room while she talked. Oddly enough, this was just what he wanted, and he always asked for Mameha when he came to town. After 2 more years of parties and outings, all the while continuing with my studies and participating in dance performances whenever I could, I made the shift from being an apprentice to being a geisha. This was the summer of 1938, when I was 18 years old. We call this change turning the collar, because an apprentice wears a red collar while a geisha wears a white one. Though if you were to see an apprentice and a geisha side by side, their collars would be the last thing you'd notice. The apprentice, with her elaborate long-sleeved kimono and dangling obi, would probably make you think of a Japanese doll, whereas the geisha would look simpler, perhaps, but also more womanly. The day I turned my collar was one of the happiest days of Mother's life, or at least she acted more pleased than I'd ever seen her. I didn't understand it at the time, but it's perfectly clear to me now what she was thinking. You see, a geisha, unlike an apprentice, is available to a man for more than just pouring his tea, provided the terms are suitable. Because of my connection with Mameha and my popularity in Gion, my standing was such that Mother had plenty of cause for excitement, excitement being, in Mother's case, just another word for money. Since moving to New York, I've learned what the word geisha really means to most Westerners. From time to time, at elegant parties, I've been introduced to some young woman or other in a splendid dress and jewelry. When she learns I was once a geisha in Kyoto, she forms her mouth into a sort of smile, although the corners don't turn up quite as they should. She has no idea what to say. And then the burden of conversation falls to the man or woman who has introduced us, because I've never really learned much English, even after all these years. Of course, by this time, there's little point even in trying, because this woman is thinking, "My goodness, I'm talking with a prostitute." A moment later, she's rescued by her escort, a wealthy man a good 30 or 40 years older than she is. Well, I often find myself wondering why she can't sense how much we really have in common. She is a kept woman, you see, and in my day, so was I. I'm sure there are a great many things I don't know about these young women in their splendid dresses, but I often have the feeling that without their wealthy husbands or boyfriends, many of them would be struggling to get by and might not have the same proud opinions of themselves. And of course, the same thing is true for a first-class geisha. It is all very well for a geisha to go from party to party and be popular with a great many men, but a geisha who wishes to become a star is completely dependent on having a donna. Even Mameha, who became famous on her own because of an advertising campaign, would soon have lost her standing and been just another geisha if the Baron hadn't covered the expenses to advance her career. No more than 3 weeks after I turned my collar, Mother came to me one day while I was eating a quick lunch in the reception room and sat across the table a long while puffing on her pipe. I'd been reading a magazine, but I stopped out of politeness, even though Mother didn't seem at first to have much to say to me. After a time, she put down her pipe and said, "You shouldn't eat those yellow pickles. They'll rot your teeth. Look at what they did to mine." It had never occurred to me that Mother believed her stained teeth had anything to do with eating pickles. When she'd finished giving me a good view of her mouth, she picked up her pipe again and took in a puff of smoke. "Auntie loves yellow pickles, ma'am," I said, "and her teeth are fine." "Who cares if Auntie's teeth are fine? She doesn't make money from having a pretty little mouth. Tell the cook not to give them to you. Anyway, I didn't come here to talk to you about pickles. I came to tell you that this time next month you'll have Adana."
"Adana? But, Mother, I'm only 18.
"Hatsumomo didn't have Adana until she was 20, and of course that didn't last. You ought to be very pleased."
"Oh, I am very pleased, but won't it require a lot of my time to keep Adana happy? Mameha thinks I should establish my reputation first, just for a few years."
"Mameha! What does she know about business? The next time I want to know when to giggle at a party, I'll go and ask her." Nowadays, young girls, even in Japan, are accustomed to jumping up from the table and shouting at their mothers, but in my day we bowed and said, "Yes, ma'am," and apologized for having been troublesome, and that's exactly how I responded. "Leave the business decisions to me," Mother went on. "Only a fool would pass up an offer like the one Nobu Toshikazu has made." My heart nearly stopped when I heard this. I suppose it was obvious that Nobu would one day propose himself as my Dana. After all, he'd made an offer for my Mizuage several years earlier, and since then had certainly asked for my company more frequently than any other man. I can't pretend I hadn't thought of this possibility, but that isn't to say I'd ever believed it was the course my life would really take. On the day I first met Nobu at the sumo tournament, my almanac reading had been, "A balance of good and bad can open the door to destiny." Nearly every day since, I'd thought of it in one way or another, good and bad. Well, it was Mameha and Hatsumomo, it was my adoption by Mother and the Mizuage that had brought it about, and of course it was the chairman and Nobu. I don't mean to suggest I disliked Nobu, quite the opposite, but to become his mistress would have closed off my life from the chairman forever. Mother must have noticed something of the shock I felt at hearing her words, or in any case she wasn't pleased at my reaction, but before she could respond we heard a noise in the hallway outside like someone suppressing a cough, and in a moment Hatsumomo stepped into the open doorway. She was holding a bowl of rice, which was very rude of her. She never should have walked away from the table with it. When she'd swallowed, she let out a laugh.
"Mother," she said, "are you trying to make me choke?"
Apparently she'd been listening to our conversation while she ate her lunch.
"So the famous Sayuri is going to have Nobu Toshikazu as her Dana," she went on. "Isn't that sweet?"
"If you've come here to say something useful, then say it," Mother told her.
"Yes, I have," Hatsumomo said gravely, and she came and knelt at the table. "Sayuri-san, you may not realize it, but one of the things that goes on between a geisha and her Dana can cause the geisha to become pregnant. Do you understand? And a man will become very upset if his mistress gives birth to another man's child. In your case, you must be especially careful, because Nobu will know at once if the child should happen to have two arms like the rest of us, that it can't possibly be his." Hatsumomo thought her little joke was very funny.
"Perhaps you should cut off one of your arms, Hatsumomo," said Mother, "if it will make you as successful as Nobu Toshikazu has been."
"And probably it would help, too, if my face looked like this," she said, smiling, and picked up her rice bowl so we could see what was in it. She was eating rice mixed with red adzuki beans, and in a sickening way, it did look like blistered skin.
As the afternoon progressed, I began to feel dizzy, with a strange buzzing in my head, and soon made my way to Mameha's apartment to talk with her. I sat at her table sipping at my chilled barley tea, for we were in the heat of summer, and trying not to let her see how I felt. Reaching the chairman was the one hope that had motivated me all through my training. If my life would be nothing more than Nobu and dance recitals, and evening after evening in Gion, I couldn't think why I had struggled so. Already Mameha had waited a long while to hear why I'd come, but when I set my glass of tea down on the table,
I was afraid my voice would crack if I tried to speak. I took a few more moments to compose myself, and then finally swallowed and managed to say, "Mother tells me that within a month it's likely I'll have a Donna."
"Yes, I know, and the Donna will be Nobu Toshikazu." By this time I was concentrating so hard on holding myself back from crying, I could no longer speak at all.
"Nobu-san is a good man," she said, "and very fond of you."
"Yes, but Mameha-san, I don't know how to say it. This was never what I imagined."
"What do you mean? Nobu-san has always treated you kindly."
"But Mameha-san, I don't want kindness."
"Don't you? I thought we all wanted kindness. Perhaps what you mean is that you want something more than kindness, and that is something you're in no position to ask." Of course, Mameha was quite right. When I heard these words, my tears simply broke through the fragile wall that had held them, and with a terrible feeling of shame, I laid my head upon the table and let them drain out of me. Only when I'd composed myself afterward did Mameha speak.
"What did you expect, Sayori?" she asked.
"Something besides this."
"I understand you may find Nobu difficult to look at, perhaps, but..."
"Mameha-san, it isn't that. Nobu-san is a good man, as you say. It's just that..."
"It's just that you want your destiny to be like Shizue's. Is that it?" Shizue, though she wasn't an especially popular geisha, was considered by everyone in Gion to be the most fortunate of women. For 30 years she'd been the mistress of a pharmacist. He wasn't a wealthy man, and she wasn't a beauty, but you could have looked all over Kyoto and not found two people who enjoyed each other's company as they did. As usual, Mameha had come closer to the truth than I wanted to admit.
"You're 18 years old, Sayori," she went on. "Neither you nor I can know your destiny. You may never know it. Destiny isn't always like a party at the end of the evening. Sometimes it's nothing more than struggling through life from day to day."
"But Mameha-san, how cruel!"
"Yes, it is cruel," she said, "but none of us can escape destiny."
"Please, it isn't a matter of escaping my destiny or anything of that sort. Nobu-san is a good man, just as you say. I know I should feel nothing but gratitude for his interest, but there are so many things I've dreamed about."
"And you're afraid that once Nobu has touched you, after that they can never be? Really, Sayori, what did you think life as a geisha would be like? We don't become geisha so our lives will be satisfying. We become geisha because we have no other choice."
"Oh, Mameha-san, please. Have I really been so foolish to keep my hopes alive that perhaps one day..."
"Young girls hope all sorts of foolish things, Sayori. Hopes are like hair ornaments. Girls want to wear too many of them. When they become old women, they look silly wearing even one." I was determined not to lose control of my feelings again. I managed to hold in my tears except the few that squeezed out of me like sap from a tree.
"Mameha-san," I said, "do you have strong feelings for the Baron?"
"The Baron has been a good Dana to me."
"Yes, of course that's true. But do you have feelings for him as a man? I mean, some geisha do have feelings for their Dana, don't they?"
"The Baron's relationship with me is convenient for him, and very beneficial to me. If our dealings were tinged with passion, well, passion can quickly slip over into jealousy or even hatred. I certainly can't afford to have a powerful man upset with me. I've struggled for years to carve out a place for myself in Gion, but if a powerful man makes up his mind to destroy me, well, he'll do it. If you want to be successful, Sayori, you must be sure that men's feelings remain always under your control. The Baron may be hard to take at times, but he has plenty of money, and he's not afraid to spend it, and he doesn't want children, thank heavens. Nobu will certainly be a challenge for you. He knows his own mind much too well. I won't be surprised if he expects more of you than the Baron has expected of me."
"But, Mameha-san, what about your own feelings? I mean, hasn't there ever been a man..."
I wanted to ask if there had ever been a man who brought out feelings of passion in her, but I could see that her irritation with me, if it had been only a bud until then, had burst into full bloom now. She drew herself up with her hands in her lap. I think she was on the point of rebuking me,
but I apologized for my rudeness at once, and she settled back again. "You and Nobu have an N, Sayuri, and you can't escape it," she said. I knew even then that she was right. An N is a karmic bond lasting a lifetime. Nowadays, many people seem to believe their lives are entirely a matter of choice, but in my day, we viewed ourselves as pieces of clay that forever show the fingerprints of everyone who has touched them. Nobu's touch had made a deeper impression on me than most. No one could tell me whether he would be my ultimate destiny, but I had always sensed the N between us. Somewhere in the landscape of my life, Nobu would always be present. But could it really be that of all the lessons I'd learned, the hardest one lay just ahead of me? Would I really have to take each of my hopes and put them away where no one would ever see them again, where not even I would ever see them? "Go back to the Okia, Sayuri," Mameha told me. "Prepare for the evening ahead of you. There's nothing like work for getting over a disappointment." I looked up at her with the idea of making one last plea, but when I saw the expression on her face, I thought better of it. I can't say what she was thinking, but she seemed to be peering into nothingness with her perfect oval face creased in the corners of her eyes and mouth from strain. And then she let out a heavy breath and gazed down into her teacup with what I took as a look of bitterness. A woman living in a grand house may pride herself on all her lovely things, but the moment she hears the crackle of fire, she decides very quickly which are the few she values most. In the days after Mameha and I had spoken, I certainly came to feel that my life was burning down around me, and yet when I struggled to find even a single thing that would still matter to me after Nobu had become my Dana, I'm sorry to say that I failed. One evening, while I was kneeling at a table in the Ichiriki tea house, trying not to think too much about my feelings of misery, I had a sudden thought of a child lost in the snowy woods, and when I looked up at the white-haired men I was entertaining, they looked so much like snow-capped trees all around me that I felt for one horrifying moment I might be the sole living human in all the world. The only parties at which I managed to convince myself that my life might still have some purpose, however small, were the ones attended by military men. Already in 1938, we'd all grown accustomed to daily reports about the war in Manchuria, and we were reminded every day of our troops overseas by things like the so-called Rising Sun lunchbox, which was a pickled plum in the center of a box of rice, looking like the Japanese flag. For several generations, Army and Navy officers would come to Gion to relax, but now they began to tell us with watery eyes after their seventh or eighth cup of sake that nothing kept their spirits up so much as their visits to Gion. Probably this was the sort of thing military officers say to the women they talk with, but the idea that I, who was nothing more than a young girl from the seashore, might truly be contributing something important to the nation. I won't pretend these parties did anything to lessen my suffering, but they did help remind me just how selfish my suffering really was. A few weeks passed, and then one evening in a hallway at the Ichiriki, Mameha suggested the time had come to collect on her bet with Mother. I'm sure you'll recall that the two of them had wagered about whether my debts would be repaid before I was 20. As it turned out, of course, they'd been repaid already, though I was only 18. "Now that you've turned your collar," Mameha said to me, "I can't see any reason to wait longer." This is what she said, but I think the truth was more complicated. Mameha knew that Mother hated settling debts and would hate settling them still more when the stakes went higher. My earnings would go up considerably after I took Adana. Mother was certain to grow only more protective of the income. I'm sure Mameha thought it best to collect what she was owed as soon as possible and worry about future earnings in the future. Several days afterward, I was summoned downstairs to the reception room of our Okia to find Mameha and Mother across the table from each other, chatting about the summer weather. Beside Mameha was a gray-haired woman named Mrs. Okada, whom I'd met a number of times. She was mistress of the Okia where Mameha had once lived, and she still took care of Mameha's accounting in exchange for a portion of the income. I'd never seen her look more serious, peering down at the table with no interest in the conversation at all. "There you are," Mother said to me. "Your older sister has kindly come to visit, and has brought Mrs. Okada with her. You certainly owe them the courtesy of joining us." Mrs. Okada spoke up, with her eyes still on the tabletop.
Mrs. Nitta, as Mameha may have mentioned on the telephone, this is more a business call than a social call. There is no need for Sayori to join us. I'm sure she has other things to do.
I won't have her showing disrespect to the two of you, Mother replied. She'll join us at the table for the few minutes you're here. So I arranged myself beside Mother, and the maid came in to serve tea. Afterward, Mameha said,
"You must be very proud, Mrs. Nitta, of how well your daughter is doing. Her fortunes have surpassed expectations, wouldn't you agree?"
"Well now, what do I know about your expectations, Mameha-san?" said Mother. After this, she clenched her teeth and gave one of her peculiar laughs, looking from one of us to the other, to be sure we appreciated her cleverness. No one laughed with her, and Mrs. Okada just adjusted her glasses and cleared her throat. Finally, Mother added, "As for my own expectations, I certainly wouldn't say Sayori has surpassed them."
"When we first discussed her prospects a number of years ago," Mameha said, "I had the impression you didn't think much of her. You were reluctant even to have me take on her training."
"I wasn't sure it was wise to put Sayori's future in the hands of someone outside the Okia, if you'll forgive me," said Mother. "We do have our Hatsumomo, you know."
"Oh, come now, Mrs. Nitta," Mameha said with a laugh. "Hatsumomo would have strangled the poor girl before she'd have trained her."
"I admit Hatsumomo can be difficult. But when you spot a girl like Sayori with something a little different, you have to be sure to make the right decisions at the right times, such as the arrangement you and I made, Mameha-san. I expect you've come here today to settle our account."
"Mrs. Okada has been kind enough to write up the figures," Mameha replied. "I'd be grateful if you would have a look at them."
Mrs. Okada straightened her glasses and took an accounting book from a bag at her knee. Mameha and I sat in silence while she opened it on the table and explained her columns of figures to Mother.
"These figures for Sayori's earnings over the past year," Mother interrupted. "My goodness, I only wish we'd been so fortunate as you seem to think. They're higher even than the total earnings of our Okia."
"Yes, the numbers are most impressive," Mrs. Okada said, "but I do believe they are accurate. I've kept careful track through the records of the Gion Registry Office." Mother clenched her teeth and laughed at this, I suppose because she was embarrassed at having been caught in her lie.
"Perhaps I haven't watched the accounts as carefully as I should have," she said.
After 10 or 15 minutes, the two women agreed on a figure representing how much I'd earned since my debut. Mrs. Okada took a small abacus from her bag and made a few calculations, writing down numbers on a blank page of an account book. At last, she wrote down a final figure and underscored it. "Here, then, is the amount Mameha-san is entitled to receive."
"Considering how helpful she has been to our Sayori," Mother said, "I'm sure Mameha-san deserves even more. Unfortunately, according to our arrangements, Mameha agreed to take half of what a geisha in her position might usually take, until after Sayori had repaid her debts. Now that the debts are repaid, Mameha is of course entitled to the other half, so that she will have earned the full amount."
"My understanding is that Mameha did agree to take half wages," Mrs. Okada said, "but was ultimately to be paid double. This is why she agreed to take a risk. If Sayori had failed to repay her debts, Mameha would have received nothing more than half wages. But Sayori has succeeded, and Mameha is entitled to double."
"Really, Mrs. Okada, can you imagine me agreeing to such terms?" Mother said. "Everyone in Gion knows how careful I am with money. It's certainly true that Mameha has been helpful to our Sayori. I can't possibly pay double, but I'd like to propose offering an additional 10%. If I may say so, it seems generous, considering that our Okia is hardly in a position to throw money around carelessly."
The word of a woman in Mother's position should have been assurance enough, and with any woman but Mother, it certainly would have been. But now that she'd made up her mind to lie, well, we all sat in silence a long moment. Finally, Mrs. Okada said,
"Mrs. Nitta, I do find myself in a difficult position. I remember quite clearly what Mameha told me."
"Of course you do," Mother said. "Mameha has her memory of the conversation, and I have mine. What we need is a third party, and happily we have one here with us. Sayori may only have been a girl at the time,
but she has quite a head for numbers.
I'm sure her memory is excellent, Mrs. Okada remarked, but one can hardly say she has no personal interest. After all, she is the daughter of the Okia.
Yes, she is, said Mameha, and this was the first time she'd spoken up in quite a while. But she's also an honest girl. I'm prepared to accept her answer, provided that Mrs. Nitta will accept it too.
Of course I will, Mother said, and put down her pipe.
Now then, Sayuri, which is it?
If I'd been given a choice between sliding off the roof to break my arm again just the way I did as a child, or sitting in that room until I came up with an answer to the question they were asking me, I certainly would have marched right up the stairs and climbed the ladder onto the roof. Of all the women in Gion, Mameha and Mother were the two most influential in my life, and it was clear to me I was going to make one of them angry. I had no doubt in my mind of the truth, but on the other hand, I had to go on living in the Okia with Mother. Of course, Mameha had done more for me than anyone in Gion. I could hardly take Mother's side against her.
Well, Mother said to me, as I recall, Mameha did accept half wages, but you agreed to pay her double earnings in the end, Mother. I'm sorry, but this is the way I remember it.
There was a pause, and then Mother said, well, I'm not as young as I used to be. It isn't the first time my memory has misled me.
We all have these sorts of problems from time to time, Mrs. Okada replied. Now, Mrs. Nitta, what was this about offering Mameha an additional 10%? I assume you meant 10% over the double you originally agreed to pay her.
If only I were in a position to do such a thing, Mother said.
But you offered it only a moment ago. Surely you haven't changed your mind so quickly.
Mrs. Okada wasn't gazing at the tabletop any longer, but was staring directly at Mother. After a long moment, she said,
I suppose we'll let it be. In any case, we've done enough for one day. Why don't we meet another time to work out the final figure?
Mother wore a stern expression on her face, but she gave a little bow of assent and thanked the two of them for coming.
I'm sure you must be very pleased, Mrs. Okada said, while putting away her abacus and her accounting book, that Sayuri will soon be taking Adana, and at only 18 years of age. How young to take such a big step!
Mameha would have done well to take Adana at that age herself, Mother replied.
18 is a bit young for most girls, Mameha said, but I'm certain Mrs. Nitta has made the right decision in Sayuri's case.
Mother puffed on her pipe a moment, peering at Mameha across the table. My advice to you, Mameha-san, she said, is that you stick to teaching Sayuri about that pretty way of rolling her eyes. When it comes to business decisions, you may leave them to me.
I would never presume to discuss business with you, Mrs. Nitta. I'm convinced your decision is for the best. But may I ask, is it true the most generous offer has come from Nobu Toshikazu?
His has been the only offer. I suppose that makes it the most generous.
The only offer? What a pity. The arrangements are so much more favorable when several men compete. Don't you find it so?
As I say, Mameha-san, you can leave the business decisions to me. I have in mind a very simple plan for arranging favorable terms with Nobu Toshikazu.
If you don't mind, Mameha said, I'd be very eager to hear it.
Mother put her pipe down on the table. I thought she was going to reprimand Mameha, but in fact, she said,
yes, I'd like to tell it to you now that you mention it. You may be able to help me. I've been thinking that Nobu Toshikazu will be more generous if he finds out an Iwamura electric heater killed our granny. Don't you think so?
Oh, I know very little about business, Mrs. Nitta.
Perhaps you or Sayuri should let it slip in conversation the next time you see him. Let him know what a terrible blow it was. I think he'll want to make it up to us.
Yes, I'm sure that's a good idea, Mameha said. Still, it's disappointing. I had the impression another man had expressed interest in Sayuri.
100 yen is 100 yen, whether it comes from this man or that one.
That would be true in most cases, Mameha said, but the man I'm thinking of is General Totori Junosuke. At this point in the conversation, I lost track of what the two of them were saying, for I'd begun to realize that Mameha was making an effort to rescue me from Nobu. I certainly hadn't expected such a thing.
I had no idea whether she'd changed her mind about helping me or whether she was thanking me for taking her side against Mother. Of course, it was possible she wasn't really trying to help me at all, but had some other purpose. My mind went on racing with these thoughts until I felt Mother tapping my arm with the stem of her pipe. "Well?" she said.
"Ma'am?"
I asked if you know the General.
"I've met him a few times, Mother," I said. "He comes to Gion often."
I don't know why I gave this response. The truth is, I'd met the General more than a few times. He came to parties in Gion every week, though always as the guest of someone else. He was a bit on the small side, shorter than I was, in fact, but he wasn't the sort of person you could overlook, any more than you could overlook a machine gun. He moved very briskly and was always puffing on one cigarette after another, so that wisps of smoke drifted in the air around him like the clouds around a train idling on the tracks. One evening, while slightly drunk, the General had talked to me for the longest time about all the various ranks in the army, and found it very funny that I kept mixing them up. General Tottori's own rank was Shoujo, which meant little general, that is to say, the lowest of the generals. And foolish girl that I was, I had the impression this wasn't very high. He may have played down the importance of his rank from modesty, but I didn't know any better than to believe him. By now, Mameha was telling Mother that the general had just taken a new position. He'd been put in charge of something called military procurement, though as Mameha went on to explain it, the job sounded like nothing more than a housewife going to the market. If the army had a shortage of ink pads, for example, the general's job was to make sure it got the ink pads it needed, and at a very favorable price. "With his new job," said Mameha, "the general is now in a position to take a mistress for the first time, and I'm quite sure he has expressed an interest in Sayuri."
"Why should it matter to me if he's expressed an interest in Sayuri?" Mother said. "These military men never take care of geisha the way a businessman or an aristocrat does."
"That may be true, Mrs. Nitta, but I think you'll find that General Tottori's new position could be of great help to the Okya."
"Nonsense. I don't need help taking care of the Okya. All I need is a steady, generous income, and that's the one thing a military man can't give me."
"Those of us in Gion have been fortunate so far," Mameha said. "But shortages will affect us if the war continues."
"I'm sure they would if the war continued," Mother said. "This war will be over in 6 months."
"And when it is, the military will be in a stronger position than ever before. Mrs. Nitta, please don't forget that General Tottori is the man who oversees all the resources of the military. No one in Japan is in a better position to provide you with everything you want, whether the war continues or not. He approves every item passing through all the ports in Japan." As I later learned, what Mameha had said about General Tottori wasn't quite true. He was in charge of only one of five large administrative areas, but he was senior to the men who oversaw the other districts, so he may as well have been in charge. In any case, you should have seen how Mother behaved after Mameha had said this. You could almost see her mind at work as she thought about having the help of a man in General Tottori's position. She glanced at the teapot, and I could just imagine her thinking, "Well, I haven't had any trouble getting tea, not yet, though the price has gone up." And then, probably without even realizing what she was doing, she put one hand inside her obi and squeezed her silk bag of tobacco as if to see how much remained. Mother spent the next week going around Gion and making one phone call after another to learn as much as she could about General Tottori. She was so immersed in this task that sometimes when I spoke to her, she didn't seem to hear me. I think she was so busy with her thoughts, her mind was like a train pulling too many cars. During this period, I continued seeing Nobu whenever he came to Gion and did my best to act as though nothing had changed. Probably, he'd expected I would be his mistress by the middle of July. Certainly, I'd expected it, but even when the month came to a close, his negotiations seemed to have led nowhere. Several times during the following weeks, I noticed him looking at me with puzzlement. And then, one night, he greeted the mistress of the Ichiriki Tea House in the curtest manner I've ever seen, by strolling past without so much as a nod. The mistress had always valued Nobu as a customer, and gave me a look that seemed surprised and worried all at once. When I joined the party Nobu was giving,
I couldn't help noticing signs of anger, a rippling muscle in his jaw, and a certain briskness with which he tossed sake into his mouth. I can't say I blamed him for feeling as he did. I thought he must consider me heartless to have repaid his many kindnesses with neglect. I fell into a gloomy spell thinking these thoughts, until the sound of a sake cup set down with a tick startled me out of it. When I looked up, Nobu was watching me. Guests all around him were laughing and enjoying themselves, and there he sat with his eyes fixed on me, as lost in his thoughts as I had been in mine. We were like two wet spots in the midst of burning charcoal. Chapter 26. During September of that year, while I was still 18 years old, General Tottori and I drank sake together in a ceremony at the Ichiriki Tea House. This was the same ceremony I'd first performed with Mameha when she became my older sister, and later with Dr. Crab just before my Mizuage. In the weeks afterward, everyone congratulated Mother for having made such a favorable alliance. On that very first night after the ceremony, I went on the general's instructions to a small inn in the northwest of Kyoto called Suruya, with only three rooms. I was so accustomed by this time to lavish surroundings that the shabbiness of the Suruya surprised me. The room smelled of mildew, and the tatami were so bloated and sodden that they seemed to make a sighing noise when I stepped on them. Plaster had crumbled near the floor in one corner. I could hear an old man reading a magazine article aloud in an adjacent room. The longer I knelt there, the more out of sorts I felt, so that I was positively relieved when the general finally arrived, even though he did nothing more, after I had greeted him, than turn on the radio and sit drinking a beer. After a time, he went downstairs to take a bath. When he returned to the room, he took off his robe at once and walked around completely naked, toweling his hair, with his little round belly protruding below his chest and a great patch of hair beneath it. I had never seen a man naked before, and I found the general's sagging bottom almost comical, but when he faced me, I must admit my eyes went straight to where, well, to where his eel ought to have been. Something was flapping around there, but only when the general lay on his back and told me to take off my clothes did it begin to surface. He was such a strange little nugget of a man, but completely unabashed about telling me what to do. I'd been afraid I'd have to find some way of pleasing him, but as it turned out, all I had to do was follow orders. In the 3 years since my mizuage, I'd forgotten the sheer terror I'd felt when the doctor finally lowered himself onto me. I remembered it now, but the strange thing was that I didn't feel terror so much as a kind of vague queasiness. The general left the radio on, and the lights as well, as if he wanted to be sure I saw the drabness of the room clearly, right down to the water stain on the ceiling. As the months passed, this queasiness went away, and my encounters with the general became nothing more than an unpleasant twice-weekly routine. Sometimes I wondered what it might be like with the chairman, and to tell the truth, I was a bit afraid it might be distasteful, just as with the doctor and the general. Then something happened to make me see things differently. Around this time, a man named Yasuda Akira, who'd been in all the magazines because of the success of a new kind of bicycle light he'd designed, began coming to Gion regularly. He wasn't welcome at the Ichiriki yet, and probably couldn't have afforded it in any case, but he spent 3 or 4 evenings a week at a little tea house called Tatematsu, in the Tominanga-cho section of Gion, not far from our Okia. I first met him at a banquet one night during the spring of 1939 when I was 19 years old. He was so much younger than the men around him, probably no more than 30, that I noticed him the moment I came into the room. He had the same sort of dignity as the chairman. I found him very attractive, sitting there with his shirt sleeves rolled up and his jacket behind him on the mats. For a moment, I watched an old man nearby who raised up his chopsticks with a little piece of braised tofu and his mouth already as wide as it would go. This gave me the impression of a door being slid open so that a turtle could march slowly through. By contrast, it made me almost weak to see the way Yasuda-san, with his graceful sculpted arm, put a bite of braised beef into his mouth with his lips parted sensuously. I made my way around the circle of men, and when I came to him and introduced myself, he said, "I hope you'll forgive me."
"Forgive you? Why, what have you done?" I asked him.
"I've been very rude," he replied. "I haven't been able to take my eyes off you all evening."
On impulse, I reached into my obi for the brocade card holder I kept there and discreetly removed one card, which I passed to him. Geisha always carry name cards with them, just as businessmen carry business cards. Mine was very small, half the size of an ordinary calling card, printed on heavy rice paper with only the words Gion and Sayuri written on it in calligraphy. It was spring, so I was carrying cards decorated with a colorful spray of plum blossoms in the background. Yasuda admired it for a moment before putting it into his shirt pocket. I had the feeling no words we spoke could be as eloquent as this simple interaction, so I bowed to him and went on to the next man. From that day, Yasuda-san began asking me to the Tatematsu tea house every week to entertain him. I was never able to go as often as he wanted me. But about 3 months after we first met, he brought me a kimono one afternoon as a gift. I felt very flattered, even though, in truth, it wasn't a sophisticated robe, woven with a poor-quality silk in somewhat garish colors and with a commonplace design of flowers and butterflies. He wanted me to wear it for him one evening soon, and I promised him I would. But when I returned to the oki with it that night, Mother saw me carrying the package up the stairs and took it away from me to have a look. She sneered when she saw the robe and said she wouldn't have me seen in anything so unattractive. The very next day, she sold it. When I'd found out what she'd done, I said to her as boldly as I dared that the robe had been given to me as a gift, not to the okia, and that it wasn't right for her to have sold it. "Certainly it was your robe," she said, "but you are the daughter of the okia. What belongs to the okia belongs to you, and the other way around as well." I was so angry at Mother after this that I couldn't even bring myself to look at her. As for Yasuda-san, who'd wanted to see the robe on me, I told him that because of its colors and its butterfly motif, I could wear it only very early in the spring, and since it was now already summer, nearly a year would have to pass before he could see me in it. He didn't seem too upset to hear this. "What is a year?" he said, looking at me with penetrating eyes. "I'd wait a good deal longer depending on what I was waiting for." We were alone in the room, and Yasuda-san put his beer glass down on the table in a way that made me blush. He reached out for my hand, and I gave it to him, expecting that he wanted to hold it a long moment in both of his before letting it go again. But to my surprise, he brought it quickly to his lips and began kissing the inside of my wrist quite passionately, in a way I could feel as far down as my knees. I think of myself as an obedient woman. Up until this time, I'd generally done the things told to me by Mother or Mameha or even Hatsumomo when I'd had no other choice. But I felt such a combination of anger at Mother and longing for Yasuda-san that I made up my mind right then to do the very thing Mother had ordered me most explicitly not to do. I asked him to meet me in that very tea house at midnight, and I left him there alone. Just before midnight, I came back and spoke to a young maid. I promised her an indecent sum of money if she would see to it that no one disturbed Yasuda-san and me in one of the upstairs rooms for half an hour. I was already there, waiting in the dark, when the maid slid open the door, and Yasuda-san stepped inside. He dropped his fedora onto the mats and pulled me to my feet even before the door was closed. To press my body against his felt so satisfying, like a meal after a long spell of hunger. No matter how hard he pressed himself against me, I pressed back harder. Somehow, I wasn't shocked to see how expertly his hands slipped through the seams in my clothing to find my skin. I won't pretend I experienced none of the clumsy moments I was accustomed to with the general, but I certainly didn't notice them in the same way. My encounters with the general reminded me of a time as a child when I'd struggled to climb a tree and pluck away a certain leaf at the top. It was all a matter of careful movements, bearing the discomfort until I finally reached my goal. But with Yasuda-san, I felt like a child running freely down a hill. Some time later, when we lay exhausted upon the mats together, I moved his shirt tail aside and put my hand on his stomach to feel his breathing. I had never in my life been so close to another human being before, though we hadn't spoken a word. It was only then that I understood.
It was one thing to lie still on the futon for the doctor or the general. It would be something quite different with the chairman. Many a geisha's day-to-day life has changed dramatically after taking a dana, but in my case, I could hardly see any change at all. I still made the rounds of Gion at night, just as I had over the past few years. From time to time, during the afternoons, I went on excursions, including some very peculiar ones, such as accompanying a man on his visit to his brother in the hospital. But as for the changes I'd expected, the prominent dance recitals paid for by my Donna, lavish gifts provided by him, even a day or two of paid leisure time, well, none of these things happened. It was just as Mother had said. Military men didn't take care of a geisha the way a businessman or an aristocrat did. The general may have brought about very little change in my life, but it was certainly true that his alliance with the Okia was invaluable, at least from Mother's point of view. He covered many of my expenses just as a donna usually does, including the cost of my lessons, my annual registration fee, my medical expenses, and, oh, I don't even know what else, my socks, probably. But more important, his new position as Director of Military Procurement was everything Mameha had suggested, so that he was able to do things for us no other donna could have done. For example, Auntie grew ill during March of 1939. We were terribly worried about her, and the doctors were of no help. But after a telephone call to the general, an important doctor from the military hospital in the Camiglio ward called on us and provided Auntie with a packet of medicine that cured her. So, although the general may not have sent me to Tokyo for dance recitals or presented me with precious gems, no one could suggest our Okia didn't do well by him. He sent regular deliveries of tea and sugar, as well as chocolates, which were becoming scarce even in Gion. And, of course, Mother had been quite wrong about the war ending within 6 months. We couldn't have believed it at the time, but we'd scarcely seen the beginning of the dark years just ahead. During that fall, when the general became my donna, Nobu ceased inviting me to parties where I'd so often entertained him. Soon I realized he'd stopped coming to the Ichiriki altogether. I couldn't think of any reason he should do this unless it was to avoid me. With a sigh, the mistress of the Ichiriki agreed that I was probably right. At the new year, I wrote Nobu a card, as I did with all of my patrons, but he didn't respond. It's easy for me to look back now and tell you casually how many months passed, but at the time I lived in anguish. I felt I'd wronged a man who had treated me kindly, a man I'd come to think of as a friend. What was more, without Nobu's patronage, I was no longer invited to Iwamura Electric's parties, which meant I hardly stood any chance at all of seeing the chairman. Of course, the chairman still came regularly to the Ichiriki, even though Nobu didn't. I saw him quietly upbraiding a junior associate in the hallway one evening, gesturing with a fountain pen for emphasis, and I didn't dare disturb him to say hello. Another night, a worried-looking young apprentice named Nao Tzu, with a terrible underbite, was walking him to the toilet when he caught sight of me. He left Nao Tzu standing there to come and speak with me. We exchanged the usual pleasantries. I thought I saw, in his faint smile, the kind of subdued pride men often seem to feel when gazing on their own children. Before he continued on this way, I said to him, "Chairman, if there's ever an evening when the presence of another geisha or two might be helpful..." This was very forward of me, but to my relief, the chairman didn't take offense. "That's a fine idea, Sayuri," he said. "I'll ask for you." But the weeks passed, and he didn't. One evening, late in March, I dropped in on a very lively party given by the governor of Kyoto Prefecture at a tea-house called Shunju. The chairman was there, on the losing end of a drinking game, looking exhausted in shirt sleeves and with his tie loosened. Actually, the governor had lost most of the rounds, as I learned, but held his sake better than the chairman. "I'm so glad you're here, Sayuri," he said to me. "You've got to help me. I'm in trouble." To see the smooth skin of his face blotched red and his arms protruding from rolled-up shirt sleeves, I thought at once of Yasuda-san on that night at the Tatematsu tea house. For the briefest moment I had a feeling that everything in the room had vanished but the chairman and me, and that in his slightly drunken state I might lean in toward him until his arms went around me and put my lips on his. I even had a flicker of embarrassment that I'd been so obvious in my thoughts that the chairman must have understood them. But if so, he seemed to regard me just the same.